CAP Radio in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Who knew this Congress could be bipartisan? Members across party and ideological lines found a unifying force recently, housing. They recently passed federal legislation that has been called once in a lifetime. The 21st Century Road to Housing Act became law Saturday at the stroke of midnight, but this politically monumental moment received little fanfare and became law without President Trump's blessing. Ben Christopher is the housing reporter for the nonprofit newsroom Cal Matters, which partners with public media stations across the state, and he took a look at how this new federal law will impact California's chronic housing woes. He joins us now. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, so how did this new law come about?
Yeah, it's been over a year in the making. Two different legislative pushes, one from the Senate, one from the House, really focused on trying to jumpstart housing production, increasing housing supply, getting people to build again, reflecting what's become an increasingly bipartisan consensus in the halls of power in Washington, D.C., as it has become in the halls of power in California, that the nation's affordability woes when it comes to housing are by and large a product of a shortage of housing. And so this is really, to the extent that people are calling this once in a lifetime or really politically monumental, it's I think because of that, this is the first time that Congress has really taken such a keen interest in getting builders building again.
You know, as you mentioned, you know, it's been called politically monumental, once in a lifetime. But what's also interesting is that, you know, as a whole, like us as Californians or maybe Americans by and large may not or probably won't immediately feel the impacts of this pretty significant piece of legislation. It's a lot of little tweaks that collectively hope to move the needle, correct?
Correct, yeah, which makes it a little bit hard to write about as a reporter, just because we're used to talking about legislation. It's like, okay, here's the one big thing you need to know. There isn't really one big thing in this bill. It's a collection of a bunch of little things. A lot of them are really technical or very narrow, changes to the way that existing regulations work, changes to existing loan programs or financing programs. But yeah, to your point, the hope is that of supporters, that it will add up to more than the sum of its parts. But even if it does, again, this doesn't mean that renters today are going to see their rents reduced, you know, tomorrow. It means that over the long run, we might see more construction than we otherwise would. That's, again, the focus of this legislation is to get more construction to happen based on the idea that we need more supply to address a shortage. But that takes a very long time for, you know, even if everyone started, if a building boom was triggered by this legislation tomorrow, which no one is predicting, it would still be years before anyone feels the effects of that. So it's a little bit anticlimactic, but again, a lot of enthusiasm from supporters just about the political direction that this is pushing Congress in.
It's widely known that California has a housing crisis, but given that this received bipartisan support at the national level, are California's housing troubles the same across the country?
Well, you know, I'm to the extent I'm an expert in anything, I'm an expert in California, so I couldn't say exactly what the contours of the housing crisis are in, say, Montana or New York. But I will say that California, you know, we've been having affordability issues with our housing for decades. We were kind of doing it before it was cool. I think there's an extent to which a lot of the once affordable regions of the country, whether it's the South, Southeast, Southwest, certain parts of the Midwest, it's all kind of going Californian increasingly, certainly in the urban areas. And it's also international. I mean, the housing affordability concerns are really sort of a global phenomenon. So I don't think it's true to say, oh, this is just a uniquely California issue. It's no coincidence that Congress as a whole was really overwhelming in support for this, because whether you're in New York or whether you're in the Midwest or whether you're in California, if you're a legislator, you are hearing from your members about the rent being too damn high, or, you know, from older members who, you know, homeowners who are seeing their children leave the region or leave the state and taking their grandkids with them because they can't afford to live in the city where they grew up, or what have you. This is a crisis that affects everyone in every region.
you hone in on a handful of this new law's significant components. What bubbles up to the top for you?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's a little tricky to focus on any just one thing, and none of it is specifically geared towards California. But you know, I spoke to experts, kind of asking what, you know, of all these provisions, there are 56 of them. Like, what are the ones that jump out that are going to be most impactful and maybe specifically most important for California? So there are a couple. One is a change to a federal housing and economic development grant program that goes to cities and counties, the Community Development Block Grant. And they changed this formula so that cities, particularly high-cost cities, that are seeing more development than they have, that are allowing for more housing construction and actually seeing that construction, they will get more money. And those that see less or aren't seeing their fair share of construction, are still lagging, they're going to see less. I think the totals don't amount to a huge amount. It's not going to be budget breaking or budget making for any one city, but it's the first time that any expert that I've heard has heard of the federal government essentially penalizing or rewarding cities, not just for the planning that they're doing, but for the actual housing production. So that's really notable. Another one that jumps out, unfortunately, is a change to a disaster recovery program that is geared towards funneling money towards communities that are hit by natural disaster, whether it's flood or hurricane, or in the case of California, most relevantly, wildfire. And they made some sort of technical changes to that program that's going to allow those funds to go out the door much quicker. At least that's what proponents say. And so, this is a program that still hasn't gone out. The grants still have not gone out to disaster victims and survivors in Los Angeles. And so the idea is that this would get out the door a little bit more quickly.
Okay, so how does it clear up that backlog? I mean, I think a lot of people would be surprised that, you know, the survivors of the wildfires in Los Angeles, I mean, this is over a year ago, haven't received any type of disaster recovery funding.
Yeah, it's pretty wonky, but as it was explained to me, and this was all news to me, it's called the Community Development Block Grant Disaster Recovery Program. And essentially, it gets stood up with every new administration. It's never been like a permanent fixture of the federal bureaucracy. And so every time it gets stood up again, there has to be a new rulemaking process, and there has to be new standards, and, you know, who's getting the money and how much and what the requirements are and the reporting requirements. And that just takes a very long time. And so if you're a community that gets hit by, a wildfire, for example, and you're turning to this program, which can provide lots of funding for long-term recovery. This is not FEMA money, but this is for like rebuilding the infrastructure, rebuilding the homes that got destroyed. It can be, years of just kind of waiting for all the rules to get set up before the money actually goes out to the door.
The first component that you were talking about, kind of like a carrot and stick approach and even penalizing some areas across the state for not building as much as they should, which cities or counties or areas could be impacted by this the most and actually, see a cut in this funding?
Yeah, it's a really good question. It's not an analysis that I have done, but just this morning I saw a consulting group called Community Scale put out a map based on their estimates. I'm not vouching for this because I haven't looked into it. It's just something that came across my social media feed. But it's worth noting, it kind of estimated based on prior growth rates, sort of estimating which cities are going to see increases and which are going to see cuts. And it's a lot of cuts in California. Maybe not surprisingly, we are kind of notorious for not developing all that much, or not growing that much. So you see Los Angeles, Irvine, San Jose, Elk Grove, Stockton. They're all based on current trends going to see modest reductions. Whereas you see a little bit of blue elsewhere in the Bay Area, in Sacramento.
You say a modest reduction, and is that enough to motivate a city, a county to build more if it's not that big of a dent in their overall budget?
It's a good question. So there's that, and there are also innovation grants in this legislation that are also meant to get locals a little bit more interested in seeing development happen. So, perhaps it could sort of marginally push some local officials or city staff to sort of move one way or the other. I think another question, a fair critique you might hear is that cities can do all the zoning and permitting reform policy changes that anyone might ask them to do. But at the end of the day, it's developers who make the decision to build or not. And so whether there's actually going to see a steep uptick in any one city might not be totally within the city government's control. But yeah, I think again, the enthusiasm around this legislation is, to me, as I hear it, is less about any one individual policy and just about the fact that, hey, Congress is actually focused on this, and the fact that the federal government is actually trying to steer local governments one way or the other in terms of development is fairly unprecedented.
Yeah, and it's a tool in the toolbox, right? A toolbox of, 56 tools, when it comes to this law. One piece that I found particularly interesting is that there's been a pretty significant change when it comes to manufactured homes. What exactly is a manufactured home? How does it differ from other homes?
Yeah, a manufactured home is a home that is built in a factory. It's manufactured. It's regulated under federal rules, and so which allows them to be standardized. So essentially, a manufactured home can be built in California and shipped anywhere in the country, or and you don't have to navigate local permitting or design code variations. And so they're also tend to be much cheaper. You'll hear them referred colloquially as mobile homes, although that's a bit of a misnomer. Mobile homes officially don't exist, haven't existed since the 1970s. They were a new set of federal regulations went into effect in the 70s, and now they're called manufactured homes. And so up in, but sort of as a vestige of that idea that these are mobile, there has been a requirement ever since at the federal level that each mobile home be built on top of what's called a chassis, a steel chassis, which is basically just like a big metal frame that has that you can attach wheels to. And so the idea is that you can move a mobile, or excuse me, a manufactured home to a spot, put it on a foundation, and then pick it up and move it. The fact is that 95% or so of manufactured homes never move again. They are purchased by someone, put on a plot of land, and then they just stay there. And so this metal chassis requirement has been something that the manufactured housing industry has been pushing back against for quite a long time, saying it adds cost. It also makes it really hard to stack them, and so they're always, like, almost by definition, single floor buildings. Whereas without the chassis, you could technically make 2 or 3 story homes, or even multifamily homes like apartments or condos. And so this law removes the chassis requirement. There's a lot of enthusiasm around that, just because manufactured housing, there's a bit of a stigma around it in certain circles, thinking about mobile homes or trailer parks or these kinds of pejorative terms. But it is one of the most affordable options for home ownership in the country. And so I think there's a lot of hope that by reducing this requirement, not only will it make them cheaper, it will also make them a little bit more flexible. You can, again, stack them, and you can and it will not look quite so kludgy. Like, it'll look more like a quote unquote normal house.
Yeah, and it could even be 2 stories,
Yeah.
by removing that chassis. Your reporting also looked a little bit into public housing agencies across the state. They've been experiencing a bottleneck, and this law hopefully will help alleviate that bottleneck. In what way?
Yeah, so there has been a federal, well, there continues to be a federal law that sort of caps the amount of permits that public housing authorities can permit, and so this raises the cap by 100,000. Currently, it's 455,000, and or it was 455,000. Now it's 555,000, and so this opens up the capacity of a lot of public housing authorities who might have the financing to expand to do so.
The last component that you looked into really focused on large institutional investors from essentially like buying up many single family homes. What is the big change moving forward with this new law?
Yeah, I mean, to the extent that anyone has heard of this bill, who's not like really in the weeds of it, they probably heard about this. This was probably the most headline grabbing and contentious part of the legislation going back the last few months. And so where it ended up settling is that it bans any what are considered large institutional investors from buying single family homes. It defines a large institutional investor as a corporate entity of some kind that owns 350 single family homes or more. There are some exceptions. So if you're owning these to rent them out, or if you're owning these to purchase them and renovate them and then sell them again, that doesn't apply. And also, it doesn't apply to multifamily, which multifamily is actually quite, you have a much larger institutional investor presence in the multifamily, like apartment market. Single family homes are, you don't quite see that many large players playing in that part of the market, certainly not in California, where single family homes are so expensive. But it is a very politically contentious issue. A lot of people are very concerned about the role that large money, you know, Wall Street colloquially plays in the housing market. And so this was a way to address that. Although I think most policy experts I spoke to said that this is a fairly modest change.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with CalMatters housing reporter Ben Christopher about a landmark federal housing bill that just became law over the weekend with the goal of putting a dent in the nation's and California's housing shortage. In the last few minutes that we have, President Trump didn't sign this bill into law. Why?
Yeah, it's a great question. It was an act of protest, as he put it. He has been pushing for Congress to send him what has been called the Save America Act, which is a national voter ID law or bill that he wants to see go into effect before the midterms. This is not the only legislative act that he has tried to condition his support on. He's also looked at defense authorization and some appointments, saying that he wants to see the Save America Act first before signing off on any of those. What's interesting, it's been a constitutional law lesson for me, is that though he did not sign it, because he didn't veto it, it still became law, which is a provision or a process dictated by the Constitution. He didn't sign it. 10 business days later for Congress, it became law. And so that's why, despite the fact that he did not sign the bill, despite the fact that there wasn't a big high-profile signing ceremony, probably to the chagrin of many Republicans who supported it, it became law last weekend.
Because he was planning a signing ceremony, correct?
He was. Everyone was. I don't have the detailed reporting on this, but my understanding is that just a few hours before, without notifying any of the other members, he posted on Truth Social that he would not be signing it. Mm. So they had to cancel that.
Are there any other big critics of this new law?
Well, so if you look at the roll call, it's been pretty there's been a lot of, you know, overwhelming support, but there were a handful of no votes, all coming from the Republican side of the aisle. And it's, you know, to the extent that anyone has kind of spoken directly about it, it's either a combination of fairly conservative, libertarian-oriented Republicans who don't like the idea of government involvement in the housing market whatsoever, and so to the extent that this expands new existing programs or modifies existing programs or makes existing pilots permanent, they didn't like that. But I think a lot of it was motivated, you know, taking the lead of the president, who really wanted to prioritize this voting ID law, and so just as a way to sort of side with President Trump on that, they voted no. But overwhelmingly, it was supported in both chambers by both parties. Mm.
Finally, I mean, do you think that there may be more legislation like this to come? I mean, do you think that this new law maybe sparked a little bit of momentum in Congress to pass more similar legislation, maybe before the midterm or just sometime in the near future? Or is this bipartisan effort in housing a fluke?
It's a good question. I wouldn't imagine there's going to be any major legislation on this again before the midterm, just because that's coming up pretty quickly. But I wouldn't be surprised at all if this is a flavor of what's to come. I think, you know, it's similar to where the state of California was maybe 10 or even 5 years ago, where you started to see an increasingly bipartisan appetite for legislation oriented at goosing supply of housing, that kind of provides a political win for both Democrats and Republicans. And you started to see members of the state legislature, you know, going back to 2017, 18, 20, running on the idea that they are pro-housing. And so, you know, there is, particularly among a lot of younger members of Congress, many of them from California, they are similarly running on that banner, under that banner. And so I wouldn't be surprised if this is the first of more legislation like it to come.
Mm. Ben, thanks for breaking down this new law.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
That is CalMatters housing reporter Ben Christopher breaking down a landmark federal housing bill that just became law with the goal of putting a dent in the country's and California's housing shortage. Up next, for more than a decade, there's been a growing number of seniors living alone in the Central Valley. We'll learn more about this nationwide trend in people over 65 and why doctors warn there are significant health risks when living alone becomes loneliness. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.